Hello and welcome to Rapids Fire, the Accelerated Data Science Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Mahler. I am really excited for this week's episode. My guest is Wes McKinney, the creator of Pandas, the creator of Apache Aero, the founder of Ursa Labs and Ursa Computing, and we have a great conversation for you today. I'll be back at the end. Talk to you later. Wes, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Wes, I'll ask you like I ask all my guests, how did you end up here today? Give us a little bit of an idea of what your career journey has been like.
It's been quite a journey over the last 13 years or so. You know, right out of school, I found myself doing routine data analysis tasks, doing a lot of work in Excel, writing a lot of SQL queries, good old Microsoft SQL. I found that, you know, working with data and analyzing data just wasn't as easy as I thought it should be. And so, you know, I was 22 years old and I got interested in building data analysis tools. Initially, I was building them for myself. And then I thought, you know, hey, like this Python language is really promising, but there's like a gap here in terms of tools. So let me try to, you know, see where it leads. I started getting some of my colleagues to use the tools that I built, and I found that I enjoyed working with other people and building tools for them, being, you know, kind of in that feedback cycle of building tools, not only for my own use, but also, you know, being in the business of enabling other people and making them, you know, more productive. So come 2009, you know, I got permission to open source the code base that became the very first version of Pandas at the end of 2009. Went to grad school. While I was in grad school, I had the belief that there was a lot of opportunity to make Python a first-class data analysis language. So I dropped out of grad school, 2011, decided to work full-time on Pandas for a while, which I could afford to do because I had saved money in my first job and I didn't have any college debt, most importantly. So I could afford to take some time off from gainful employment to work on open source. And during that time, I wrote my book, Python for Data Analysis, tried to start a financial analytics tools company, Lambda Foundry, ultimately founded a company called DataPad. My early AQR colleague and early contributor, Chang Shu. We ended up at Cloudera 2014. And while we were at Cloudera, it became apparent to me that there was like a missing link between data science tools and database systems and big data and the big data ecosystem. And it really came down fundamentally to the data itself. And so that's how I ended up down the rabbit hole of seeing like, is there some way that we could build like a unifying technology to bring together data frame libraries and analytic database systems and other big data processing, you know, distributed data processing framework. And I was very fortunate to be at Cloudera and I found some partners in crime there at Cloudera. You know, we linked up with folks from Dremio, folks from Twitter, Hortonworks, MapR. We assembled like a group of, you know, 20, 25 people, and we decided to create the Apache Aero project to create a kind of universal data format for tabular data, a protocol for moving it around. And I've spent the last 5 years building a developer community, building the core open source libraries, recruiting people into the Aero ecosystem, working with third parties to get them to buy in on the Aero vision, plugging the gaps, making sure that the early adopters of Aero are successful. 2018, you know, early in Aero, I left Cloudera, joined 2Sigma. So 2Sigma has been funding Aero development for 4 years. So I worked on Aero kind of while I was there for 2 years. I left 2Sigma to create Ursa Labs, a nonprofit industry consortium to fund Aero development. So the idea there is that there were a lot of organizations that wanted to fund Aero development, namely by hiring me. And so I said, basically, look, I can't work for all of you. So how about we create some kind of an organization where, you know, a bunch of companies can fund Aero development. So that's how Ursa Labs came about at the beginning of 2018. Fast forward 2.5 years, it became apparent having a commercial entity standing directly behind the Apache Aero project, providing enterprise services and support for the Aero project itself, as well as creating enterprise software and managed computing services based around the core Aero platform. It was the best thing that I could be doing right now to help the ecosystem continue to grow and be successful and do right by the data science ecosystem. So we founded Ursa Computing, raised a venture round, and you know, now I'm the CEO of Ursa Computing. And so we're building, you know, a business there and continuing to drive core Aero open source project and, you know, ultimately be you know, shipping some Aero-based product in the future. So very exciting, very bright future for all this stuff, but it's been quite a path until now. And keeping all the pieces straight in my head has been challenging, but I feel like I've been kind of working on a consistent technology narrative around empowerment of data scientists, empowering of individuals, and, you know, the streamlining of tools, making them easier to use, making them faster, more powerful, more scalable. Lots and lots to do. It's been a fun ride. So we'll see what the next 10 or 13 years holds for me.
I was going to ask you, back in the early days of your career, when you were working in industry with data and Python was not the juggernaut that it is today, why did it capture your attention? Why did you decide to do things the hard way and build a library in Python to do something that Python really did not like to do at the time? I believe in a tweet you had shown a graph of the adaptation of Python, particularly in data science, based on pandas. I would invite any of our listeners to try to do data science without pandas to read and manipulate the data and see what life was like. You're working at, I believe, in a demanding analytics job in a demanding sector, as you know, I think more or less a quant in financial services. What motivated that?
Yeah, it is a good question. I think initially it was scratching an itch a little bit. Like I had, you know, I was frustrated with my own ability to be productive. And that time, 2007, 2008, you know, I worked with colleagues that used R. And R 13, 14 years ago was completely different in terms of library stack and its accessibility for data analysis than it is today. You know, some people still prefer like the old way of doing things in R, but you know, a lot of the work that, you know, Hadley Wickham has done, Tidyverse and folks in that ecosystem, you know, really made R, you know, a lot more compelling and easy to use and productive for data analysis. But at that time, didn't quite fit my brain. And so I was searching to create my like idealized tool. But at the same time, like I started learning Python for some other use cases. And I just really found the programming language really appealing in how easy it was to do work, just general purpose work, but it lacked kind of like that body of easy to use data analysis, data manipulation tools, you know, even very basic things like reading CSV files, which is very difficult. So for me, it was like partially just like an experiment to see like what could be built in Python that would be better. Like if I could create like an idealized thing that worked in the way that I wished that things worked. But yeah, it was certainly doing things the hard way. I mean, I also joke that like, remember it was 2008, like the world was collapsing around us, particularly if you worked in the financial industry. And so, you know, I think it was also like a coping mechanism, like, oh, I found this like Skunkworks, like, you know, nights and weekends project building a data analysis toolkit, like while the world, the financial world at least is ending. So I kept myself busy. And I think maybe it was like a way to get my mind off of the possibility of losing my job and that kind of thing that gave me something productive to focus on.
I hope you'll forgive me this joke, but did you name it Ursa Labs because you couldn't bear the overhead of all the copies?
Oh boy. I haven't heard that one, but yeah, no, I think we wanted a bear themed name. It's funny though, because, you know, bears are not the fastest creature, but you know, that said, I guess pandas are kind of a little bit dopey and useless. So the fact that pandas are so useful, pandas themselves kind of sit around and eat bamboo all day.
I mean, I will say that you can extend the analogy, a bear, especially a black bear, can cover all kinds of terrain. It can go through water, it can go through plains, it can climb trees. So it's suited to a lot of different
purposes. That's true. That's very true.
I remember hearing you talk at PyData Miami a couple of years ago, and you said that you never intended to be a computer scientist, and to some effect that you felt like the direction of what you wanted to do in the tooling was forcing you towards that. From the intro, it sounds like you're largely happy with that, but how has it been to be a self-taught computer scientist that's working on leading software that is feeding into so many different high-level projects?
I think it definitely has given me a bad case of imposter syndrome. So if you or if anyone listening feels imposter syndrome, like I feel it, you know, I feel it too. So the fact that I don't have a traditional computer science background, I didn't stay long enough in school to get a PhD in anything. And I collaborate with and often interact with people who have pretty, from my perspective, pretty intimidating backgrounds when it comes to computer science, software engineering. Before getting into computers, you know, I was a mathematician. So I have a degree in pure mathematics. I did mostly pen and paper in college and very little programming. I got interested in the financial world because it seemed like an interesting application domain. Again, I was at MIT, like quant firms, you know, love to hire math undergrad from colleges like MIT. It's not surprised they're recruiting people like me. So, you know, I found that programming served essentially as a tool of thought. And, you know, as you, and so your ability to express yourself and to take your ideas and build these sort of structures that express your ideas and enable you to iterate on and explore your ideas, because a lot of ideas you have can only be really determined whether or not they're good through computation. So the fact that the programming tools can become such a limiting factor in your ability to think or your ability to see whether your ideas make sense or whether, you know, you have a good idea or not, that was very bothersome to me. And so the idea of being able to, of like having an idea and then having to take like weeks of time in order to actually do the implementation in order to see whether the idea is good, you know, that's from like the perspective of human progress, that's not ideal. So you'd like to compress the feedback cycles. Like, yeah, okay, it still takes time to build, to implement things. But if you can take a project that might take a week and compress it down into a day or a half a day, I mean, that's huge in terms of, you know, putting your ideas into action.
When did you get a sense that Pandas would be as big as it was? When did you know that it was really going to take off and become, that you'd planted the seed for what it became?
I think it was in early 2013. So I think after, you know, kind of the running joke with O'Reilly was I asked O'Reilly Media, the book publisher, you know, they chose the cover for the book. It's a tree shrew, which I have no problem with. It's like, I've grown quite fond of the book cover. But, you know, I said, I asked them, I said, well, you know, well, you could put a panda on the cover. That would be appropriate, a panda. And they said, yeah, well, we're saving the, you know, we're saving the panda for something really big. So the running joke is, you know, I think the book has gone on to be one of O'Reilly's, you know, best-selling book over the last 9 years. So yeah, so it wasn't clear to anyone that things were going to develop in the way that they did. But I think by after the book was out, and by early 2013, you know, I think the field of data science had begun to emerge. And so there was like, kind of this sort of, you know, it was good, you know, good timing that suddenly there was like a good resource for people to learn to use pandas and to learn to do kind of data work in Python. So I think the book definitely helped provide like a catalyst for the ecosystem to grow. So I think it, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, was because I felt that without like a coherent, organized resource for learning, it would hold the ecosystem back. Because, you know, I think a lot of people have had the experience of wanting to learn about some open source software, and they find themselves in like a mess of like different projects, documentation, and trying to like make sense of all of it. Like, where do you start? Like, what do you learn first? How do the pieces fit together? So I think the book definitely helped, but definitely I think when the Pandas developer community started growing, I think that was the real signal to me that there was something big there. So, you know, Jeff Reback, got really involved in the project and has ended up being, you know, kind of, I was frankly the biggest contributor to the project over its lifetime. You know, a number of other people, Joris Vandenbosch and Philip Cloud and Tom Augsburger, you know, all got involved in the project around that time. And so kind of the sudden development of a developer community. And so, and the fact that Pandas was able to transition from being like my project to the community's project, I think that was where I understood. It's like, okay, like the fact that, you know, people are volunteering to, you know, take ownership of this project, and I could sort of loosen my grip on it and trust that it would be in good hands. You know, and I haven't really been actively involved in day-to-day Pandas development in about, nearly 8 years. And so the fact that I felt comfortable trusting it to that group of core maintainers kind of who came out of the woodwork and joined the project, I think that's really kind of, you know, when I was like, okay, all right, this is here to stay. I didn't realize it would get as big as it has, but, you know, at least I reckoned that, you know, it's not going to die either.
In tweets of yours that I've seen, at one point you expressed a certain frustration about certain companies that relied heavily on open source software, but were essentially free riders. And forgive me if I'm mischaracterizing that. My question is, to what degree did your early experience of both the joys and the challenges of an open source project inform the way that you decided to proceed with Arrow and build Ursa Labs?
Yeah, I mean, this is by itself, you know, a big topic of, you know, funding and sustainability of open source software. And a lot of people have weighed in on this issue and like the various nuances about it. So it's like a book that came out last year I'd recommend everyone read called Working in Public by Nadia Eggball. It's kind of a deep dive into the social and business kind of issues around this topic. But you know, for me, I think the core issue that I observe or that I've observed in my projects is the fact that the people who are in a position to invest either developer time or money or direct funding are often too far disconnected from the users of the libraries. And so what often happens is like as an open source maintainer or a core developer, you're interacting with somebody like, let's say somebody from an investment bank or, you know, from an insurance company or like a Fortune 100 company in the US. And to you, it's like very frustrating because you see like, okay, you know, you're interacting with this person, they're reporting a bug or like, they're like, oh, I'm trying to use this library and it's not working and I'm trying to get my job done. Then you look up where the person works and you see that they work for a company that has a market cap of like over $100 billion. And so it creates this kind of like visceral, like, it's like, what the hell? Like, why am I supporting like these wealthy companies? And that they don't invest money. They don't, you know, they may not invest very much developer time. So it creates a lot of cognitive dissonance, like to be interacting with all these like really wealthy corporations. And yet, you know, we have so little power to influence them to change. And there's a certain like, I think some companies, they feel that there's like a market efficiency that like, you know, they don't need to help, like they don't need to give money, like maintainers burn out, that like, you know, other maintainers will spring forth from the earth to replace them. Or if the bugs are important enough that like somebody somewhere will fix them. There's like various mistaken beliefs kind of among the consumers of open source software. But I think just like the real kind of issue is the disconnect between the people who control the purse strings and who write the checks and the people who are impacted by the software itself, the problems that occur when it's under maintained or it's got bugs or like features don't get built fast enough. It's fundamentally like a tricky problem because, you know, people don't want to pay for something that they get for free. And so just the economics around producing open source software are way different. And yet the users feel entitled to have access at any time in any place with the maintainers. And so like that entitlement, I think also chafes quite a bit. Users often express like the feeling that their use of your software is somehow like a form of payment so that maintainers feel like an obligation to them to like fix things. It's like, I already, you know, I'm invested in using your thing. So like, you know, you shouldn't allow it to be broken. So that's kind of like another pattern that I see. But in any case, it's like complaining about the rain outside. Yes, it's going to rain. What are we going to do about it? You know, we managed to, you know, erect boundaries. And I think we've learned to like not be too reactive to like entitled behavior that we see from users. But I think big picture in terms of funding and sustainability, like, you know, I've, you know, after that whole rant about, you know, open source maintenance, but I realized pretty quickly that it's important to identify organizations that are forward thinking, that understand the value of innovation. And understand that like you have to deliberately invest in the people who are bringing about that innovation and who are kind of looking after and sustaining the software. You know, you aren't going to have tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, but if you can identify the, you know, corporations which have the resources to fund the work and you find internal people in the organizations who are effectively true believers in what you're doing, That helps a great deal. And so you can find the right person who can fight the internal political battles to be able to provide sponsorship for, you know, for what you're doing. And so, you know, in the case of Apache Arrow, the true believer that I connected with, you know, early in the process, you know, to my great fortune was Two Sigma. And, you know, they were just a fantastic partner and experienced like a lot of the core problems that Arrow solves around data access performance, data transport performance, in-memory analytics performance, scalability, memory use, kind of all of the above. And so I think like finding those people or organizations who really identify with the problems you're solving, and if you can, you know, scrap together enough kind of sustainable funding or sponsorship, then you can make things work for a time. I will say now versus like 5 or 10 years ago, things are much easier now that there's multiple like fiscal conduits for funding. So in Python world, we have NumFocus, which can act as a conduit for funding for open source. It's a 501c3, so the donations are tax deductible to other organizations that serve a similar purpose. And there's also, you know, a number of commercially successful businesses which are aligned with the open source software kind of process. So for a couple of years, I was employed by RStudio, and they enabled Ursa Labs to exist. And so, you know, joining forces, you know, with RStudio to say that Arrow is about interoperability, like there's benefits to be derived from bringing the Python and R worlds together at a data level will enrich Python or enrich R. And so JJ Allaire there and Hadley Wickham, I discussed this problem space with them. And it's like, okay, they're true believers. RStudio has committed itself to investing a large fraction of its product revenue into open source software development. The star is aligning for me. I recognize, however, that kind of situation is not very reproducible. That's perhaps a bit unique to like my personal path. So not every open source project will find, you know, a successful business to sponsor their work and enable them to build a team. But it's, you know, it's worth trying. And, you know, even the fact that you can now like relatively easily get somebody to donate $5,000 or $10,000 to NumFocus and use that to fund a small development project. It used to be that just like handling the money was really difficult. And so that off prevented possible sources of funding from occurring.
With your new endeavor, Ursa Computing, or with Ursa Labs, however you'd like to answer this, what is your wildest dreams for its success?
You know, we definitely have pretty big ambitions. There's a couple of very specific problems that we want to make sure are solved well. So firstly, you know, I really admire the work that you all have done at NVIDIA with RAPIDS, building a compute foundation that is Arrow native, that uses CUDA and NVIDIA GPUs. And one of the things that we're missing at present in the Arrow ecosystem is that kind of compute engine that runs on CPUs, so x86 and ARM. That's an area that, you know, we are investing time and money. It's important to me that we see that through so that we have portable, high quality, fast and efficient data processing for Arrow data. We ultimately are interested in providing flexible, hosted, you know, managed computing services that are Arrow based and addressing some of the serious limitations that SQL based managed computing services have. So for example, it's difficult to take your custom Python logic and get that to run inside of a database system. You have things like Spark is very popular, but you also pay like a pretty substantial crossing penalty when extending Spark, with Python code. So I think the thing that's really compelling about Arrow is that by virtue of creating this universal language independent data layer for data frames, effectively, that a general purpose, either single node or multi-node data processing system can be extended with your custom Python code or your custom R code without the usual crossing penalty or data interoperability, like data conversion penalty. So it's important to me that we're putting the pieces in place to enable effectively scalable data frame computing. So efficient, fast computing at the single node scale on our multi-core laptops, multi-core desktops. Eventually, you know, we can run at much, much larger scale and have high quality programmability from any programming language that understands Arrow. We're also interested in addressing the pain points that people are experiencing around doing data engineering, data science, ETL on top of kind of the emergent modern cloud data lake model. And so really basic tooling around interacting with large data sets that are stored in cloud storage is still like fairly immature, in my opinion, in terms of like its performance, usability. And so there, I think it makes a lot of sense for Arrow to be the primary conduit in terms of, you know, where the rubber meets the road, how data is expanded into memory, like loaded out of storage, how data is transported around between different nodes in a cluster. In Arrow, like the last couple of years, we've spent a lot of development work on Arrow Flight, our data transport RPC framework for Arrow native built on top of gRPC. So we'd really like to do whatever we can to accelerate adoption of Flight so that it can become the new standard for high performance data transport, getting data out of data warehouses, data lakes, and building kind of platform architectures that can be increasingly Arrow native as time goes on. It's a bit of a chicken and egg problem. So I think, you know, our ambition for Ursa Computing is to provide the glue, the supporting computing services that are cloud native that enable this transition to being aero native to take place more quickly and to support organizations throughout that transition and into the future.
Pivoting a little bit to something that's been in the overall tech discussion more since COVID hit, do you think that remote work and people moving to cities that aren't necessarily New York or San Francisco, do you think that's going to continue? And what do you think the benefits of that are for both the communities involved and the actual workers involved?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was going to happen regardless, but COVID has greatly accelerated the process by encouraging, like, you know, mass exoduses from the major tech hubs, definitely, where cost of living is very high, the housing supply is low, and if not especially good quality, you know, as infrastructure problems. For some companies, it's going to be a painful transition because they're like culturally not set up for remote work. And so they don't have like remote first culture in their DNA. New organizations, you know, Earth's Computing, for example, is fully distributed. I think new organizations will increasingly choose to be remote first and will build their culture around that. And will take playbook that's been developed by companies like GitLab, you know, Automattic, were remote first when it wasn't nearly as trendy to do and have been successful at doing it. You know, as there are more and more success stories and more general knowledge about how to build productive and well-functioning remote distributed engineering teams, that we'll see it happening more and more. Because often I think what would happen in the past is you might have people working out of an office and then some remote people. And because like the culture is really built around that like office environment, that the remote folks end up feeling left out, in many cases hasn't worked that well. So it's, yeah, so we're definitely learning a lot. You know, I left New York in 2018 to move to Nashville. I'm bullish on, you know, smaller cities. Like, you know, I'm very excited about the future of Nashville, you know, for a long list of reasons. It happens to be that it's also, you know, relatively close to my immediate family. So there's, you know, personal reasons for me to live here beyond purely professional reasons. So yeah, I'm very excited to see how things develop. And I do think that to have less clumping of talent in the United States would be a good thing for many reasons. So anyway, we'll see what happens. I'm optimistic.
If you were, let's say, I don't know, you fake your own death and you start a new life doing some other kind of work, what kind of work do you think that would be?
That's a good question. Yeah, I have not something that I've thought about much lately.
Well, that's a very good sign, I'll say.
yeah, no, I haven't contemplated too much alternative life paths. I've always enjoyed, travel and, foreign languages and stuff. So who knows, maybe I would be a spy or something, or a translator or something of that nature, something that would enable me to participate more in international affairs. The current extent of my role of language skills in my life is when I travel to, a country for a conference where I sort of speak the language, I get, awkwardly speak that language. Of course everyone's like, oh, that's very adorable that you're speaking our language, but let's speak in English. I think the one time that served me well was I was in Colombia last February for PyCon Colombia, and Fernando Perez was there, the creator of IPython. And I was able to meet his parents and have a short conversation with them. And they were, of course, very kind and very proud of their son. And so I tried to express to them the magnitude of his contribution to our community, and from, IPython and Jupyter and everything else that Fernando has done.
When you're not working, what are things that you like to do for fun?
I do my best to stay active. I'm a runner and I do yoga pretty often. Been doing that for probably 10 years or so. Even though I'm 35 years old, I haven't outgrown video games. Despite the odds, I still make time to play some video games now and then. And there's like a weird thing about video games. Like it's particularly if you have like a day where maybe you don't make very much progress on something, or you feel like a bit frustrated, like games are a good antidote, because you sit down and like you advance in a story, or you make some, you get some achievement, in a game. And so you feel some satisfaction from that. And so I found it like a better alternative to, binge watching Netflix.
I am invested in it being socially acceptable for 35-year-olds to play video games. And I would also add, NVIDIA probably is too. What was the last game that you played that you really enjoyed. I played Last of Us 2 right before Christmas. It wasn't thematically appropriate for Christmas, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I played that. Story was a bit of a downer. I actually just finished playing Cyberpunk 2077, which despite the bugs, which for me ended up being more charming than anything, I had a lot of fun playing it. So, I would say don't believe all the bad things that you read about the game. You can, go check it out.
Well, this feels like a natural place to wrap up. Wes, this has been a great conversation. Thank you very much for the time that you've provided, both in doing this interview and in building the software that has been consistently the backbone of my career, and I think many of our listeners. Hopefully we'll have you back in the future, and I hope you have a great day.
You too. Thanks again for having me.
I want to really thank Wes again for his time, for his thoughtful answers, and above all, for his almost immeasurable contribution to the world of data science. I wouldn't be where I am today if it weren't for pandas. Rapids wouldn't be where it is today if it weren't for Apache Arrow. And everyone in the community owes him a big debt of gratitude. I hope you liked this episode. My guest next week will be Jim Scott, who's the head of developer relations for data science at NVIDIA, and we talk about his career and things that are going on in the data science community, the data science of whiskey, and a lot more. If you like this episode, remember to subscribe. If you didn't like this episode, reach out to me on Twitter @RealPaulMahler. Until next week, thanks. Bye.